This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run with Lynn Sharitz and Xiaoning. It is the 28th of June, a Friday, and we're running a poll this morning. We're asking you, should young people work first before entering into politics? Do weigh in on the conversation. Tell us what you think over on the BFM Twitter account. That's at BFM Radio. So far, 74% of the 80-odd votes we've gotten have said, yes, young people should work first. 12% have said no, 7% said it's complicated, and another 7% said they don't care. So do weigh in on the conversation, because we'll take a look at the final results later on in the morning. Now, aside from that, earlier this week, FGV's major shareholders voted against three resolutions on FGV directors' remuneration. Those major shareholders were Felda, Korporasi Permodalan Felda Malaysia, or KPF, and the Armed Forces Fund Board, or LTAT. Now, Felda holds a 34% stake in FGV, KPF about 5%, and LTAT just over 1%.
Yeah, so since then, LTAT, they've come out to defend their decision to vote against the three resolutions pertaining the remuneration of the director's fee for the financial year of 2018. Now, given, so it's stated that given prevailing economic condition and FGV's current financial standing, they are of the view that director's remuneration should commensurate with the current state of affairs at FGV and its prospect ahead. Now, we wish to emphasize that this decision was not taken lightly and was reached following considerable decision and deliberation.
Now, what's interesting is LTAT's role, because it's really believing in shareholder activism, right? And the point was that they wanted to protect the interests of LTAT contributors, which are the member of the armed forces. This is an interesting point, because in Malaysia in the past, large shareholders tended to be quite quiet. You know, they would go for AGMs, if at all, and either abstain or just vote for. And in the last 1 to 2 years, we've started to see that. You know, a classic example of this was when EPF voted against Sharil, Tan Sri Sharil's pay package at Sapura Energy, because he was going to be paid something like 71 million ringgit, which was at that time for the 2017 profit, almost 1/3 of all profits. And for 2018, Sapura had a very bad year. It was a net loss. Mm. So I think it's good that Malaysian large institutional shareholders start having a voice and protect the interests of also minority shareholders in these companies.
Yeah, I think it does reflect an overall shift as well in terms of the country and our attitude towards speaking up and speaking your mind, because we have seen that that has shown some result.
Yes.
Excuse me, I almost forgot what that word was. some results, particularly through the GE14. So it's good that now, as you say, major shareholders are starting to speak up a little bit more and perhaps buy into this idea of shareholder activism.
Yeah, because EPF also, they didn't vote against this director's remuneration with regards to FGV, but they did write in to the chairman, Dato' Wira Azhar, to actually meant to ask him about his high salary. And in the end, Dato' Azhar actually did waive his own director's fee, his chairman's fee. But at the end of the day, that wasn't enough to sway the major shareholders of FGV to vote for this resolution.
Yeah, so because we saw a big jump, especially for his pay, if we look at Dato' Wira Azhar, Abdul Hamid, in 2017, he was paid about close to $390,000. And now it's jumped to, for 2018, it's jumped to about close to $2 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I don't know. I mean, the impression that I'm getting, the result that's coming out, the resolutions that are coming out here, is that it seems a bit extreme, because we're talking about no pay. We're not talking about reduced or, you know, a portion, but we're talking about no pay. So what are they expecting here? I mean, are we expecting that the Felda board members to be, you know, perform some form of national service, at this level, and you know, at the same time trying to keep themselves motivated for the, you know, to undergo the transformation plan?
Well, the board is still deliberating this matter, right? And the issue, if you ask me, is probably not likely to be resolved anytime soon. And the options remain uncertain. But I won't be surprised if there's a bit of bargaining going on, because you can't expect the board to have zero salary, especially the executive members of the board who are doing work daily, right?
That's crazy. Imagine having to bargain. If, you know, an item, someone sells you 100 and you start off with the amount of zero.
Yeah, I was also just curious to see that the breakdown of Azhar's FY18 remuneration, because it included a director's fee of 600,000 ringgit, an annual fee of 315,000 from subsidiaries, benefits in kind amounting to about 313,000, and a salary of 415,000. But it's also, I guess, worth noting here that he did also serve as interim CEO for 3 months from October 24th until January 2019. So that's what goes into it, if you were wondering how they came up with a 1.9 million number.
But on the other flip side, we do have some corporate or some, you know, big guns out there who know that their results are bad, right? And they can see it, and they are mindful of the optics of this, especially if, you know, in the past they had like 10, 20 million salary, you know, and it just doesn't look right when your whole company is doing so badly. So, for example, AIG, and this is in 2008 during the great financial crisis, right? The AIG chief executive, he slashed his annual salary to just $1 as part of a series of like voluntary pay restrictions. Not by just him, but by top executives in that company, because they received a bailout of $150 billion. So he was just paid $1 for 2008 and 2009. So it's not the first time that you do see, but these are the people who do it voluntarily before it gets.
But
like,
didn't Dato Wira Azhar did that as well?
Did.
So he did offer, right?
He did offer. Mm-hmm. He did offer. Yeah. And yesterday we had Singtel CEO Chua Sok Kun. Her pay package was nearly half, and that was because net profit fell 44%.
And closer to home as well, Genting Malaysia's chairman and CEO Tan Sri Lim Kok Teh has taken a 20% voluntary pay cut. And this is as the group's coping with a hike in gaming taxes. So according to Genting Malaysia's 2018 corporate governance report, Lim's salaries and bonuses amounted to 50 million ringgit. And a 20% pay cut from this would amount to about 10 million of that number.
Yeah, with an earning of a collective payout of 249 million ringgit. At the same time, I think there's also other news on that. For example, two other CEOs saw a cut, better pay days. We saw DBS Group as well, CEO Piyush Gupta. You know, he saw instead, if it's based on performance, they get a pay rise. And Felda too probably have seen that before, where during the time when their CEO had the highest pay was back in 2012 or 2013, and that was the year when FGV got listed as well. So it was a good heyday for FGV. Hence, I could see why they wish to reward themselves to that amount.
But at the same time, I think we are seeing an overall government shift to reduce the wealth gap between the employees and the CEOs of companies across the country. So perhaps this is only the first steps towards that. Now, some other news also on the local front this morning is that Health Minister Dr. Zulkifli Ahmad has announced yesterday that the government plans to work towards removing criminal penalties for the personal possession and use of drugs. Now, this comes after Home Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin said earlier this week that drug addicts in this country are no longer seen as criminals who must be punished, but are patients in need of treatment and rehabilitation. Now, this is following discussions with the Health Ministry.
Yeah, so this is a big move, a big shift of mindset, isn't it? I mean, decriminalizing, because it used to be, you know, harsh penalties for those for drug addicts as well as addiction. But it's now good that we're now shifting from that mentality of punishment, but now to, you know, rehabilitation and treatment, which is important because addiction is itself is an illness. And, you know, discrimination, we look at what he spoke about on decriminalization is that removal of criminal penalties for possessing and using a small quantity of drug for personal use as opposed to those who are involved in trafficking of drugs. Now, trafficking of drugs will, understandably, remain a crime.
Yeah, he noted, our health minister noted, that drug use and addiction is actually a very complicated, complex, chronic, relapsing medical condition. And there are many reasons why someone would take to drug use and addiction. I mean, it could be genetic predisposition. It could be your surrounding environment in terms of your poverty, family breakdown, school and peer pressure can all lead to someone starting to use drugs.
There's a lot more empathy in terms of understanding how to address this issue.
But I think it is important here to note that this is a decriminalization decriminalization. Yeah. It's not the legalization of the use of drugs. Very different. It is decriminalization of personal drug use. Because at the present, the Home Minister has said there are about 70,000 prisoners in Malaysia, most of whom were drug addicts. And he added that the Home Ministry is looking at taking out certain sections of the Drug Dependence Act from being registered under the Registration of Criminals and Undesirable Persons Act. So essentially what this means is that this is giving a second chance to addicts who've been cured and released from rehabilitation centres of the National Anti-Drug Agency. Now, this isn't unusual, of course. More than 30 countries have embarked on the move to decriminalise drugs. And one of the more successful stories here is Portugal, which in 2001, the government decriminalise drugs. So if someone is found in possession of less than a 10-day supply of anything, from marijuana to heroin in Portugal, he or she will be sent to a three-person commission for the dissuasion of drug addiction, typically made up of a lawyer, a doctor, and a social worker.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that after this exercise, they saw a decline overall amongst the 15 to 25-year-old population and those who are most at risk of initiating drug use. And this is according to a UK-based NGO working in the field of drug policy and law reform. So there has always been a decline in the percentage of the population who have ever used a drug, and then they continue to do so. And also, we're looking at a situation where drug-induced death also decreasing quite significantly.
Yeah, years after this move, Portugal hasn't been run into the ground by a nation of drug addicts. In fact, drug-induced HIV infection rates among injecting drug users actually has reduced at a steady pace.
And
it's become a more manageable problem in the context of other countries with high rates. Now, another widely cited study, published in 2010 in the British Journal of Criminology found that after decriminalisation, Portugal saw an increase in imprisonment on drug-related charges alongside a surge in visits to health clinics that deal with these issues. Yeah.
I guess because what it does is that it brings this issue out of the shadows, right? Because right now what happens is that if you have a drug addiction, you know that it's a crime and you can't help yourself. So what can you do? There's no real platform for you to turn to without facing a stigma across the board. So decriminalizing it essentially will encourage drug addicts to seek rehabilitation and to seek help. And that is at the end of the day what we want, right? Because we don't want them to be drug addicts. We want them to be able to return to being normal, functioning, contributing members of society. So I think overall decriminalization is not necessarily a bad thing. And as Portugal and some other case studies have shown, it's not led to the downfall of the nation.
It's an important way to collect data as well. I mean, as you mentioned, how drug use could be a result of, for example, poverty, family issues and so forth. Mm-hmm. And again, all this comes out to formulating a data and how government could help in a raise issues such as drug use. But at the same time, speaking of, there's also talks about how another form of addiction is e-cigarette, where they're looking at into putting in more regulation on that.
Yeah, of course, there will be those as well who say that decriminalization is the first step towards legalization, towards, promoting drug use. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think it's more important to just start this conversation because it's already happening and that you need to address it somehow. You cannot just sweep it under the rug. Now, in the meantime, we are running up on the 8 o'clock news. And after that, Sharit, so we'll be speaking with Tan Sri Dr. Jamilah Mahmood, Undersecretary General for Partnerships at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Be sure to stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.